Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year, bud!
So we're pre-recording this, but this airs...
on New Year's Day.
On New Year's Day.
So all the people with hangovers can still listen, just listen to it a bit lower.
Yeah, just a little bit of lower volume.
How's your Christmas?
Fantastic.
Yeah?
It was good.
Good.
It was really good. It was a lot of time spent with family, and, you know, the kids are happy. They don't ask for much, so, you know, it's that.
So we don't give them much.
Try to make it meaningful.
You ain't asking for it. We're not getting it for you.
So, yeah, it was really good. It was
good.
It was nice to gather and gather with family and so on.
Yeah, our Christmas was fairly a bit low-key, but one big thing is the big secret we've been keeping from Tracy for the last few months is our daughter came home from Japan for Christmas. So that was the big thing. So everybody was happy with that. And now we just get to spend some time with her here for a couple of weeks before she goes back to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all's good.
That's awesome. That's great that she got to come home for Christmas and
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Well, like I say, Tracy was a bit upset because she thought this was going to be the first year with no kids in the house.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, Mackenzie's out and she was out and then all of a sudden she shows up. Not only that, but I picked up three of Arianna's best friends and brought them to the airport.
Yes.
And they surprised her at the airport.
That's awesome.
So, yeah.
Surprise.
So when we're, just as a side note here, when we were waiting at the airport, you know those big inflatable dinosaur costumes?
Oh, yes.
Arianna's got one upstairs.
Oh.
There were two people waiting for somebody wearing those dinosaur costumes. And all I could think of is, if I would have brought that one and worn, I could have joined in. And they all would have been, woo, look at that, three
dinosaurs. Who's this guy?
Who's this guy? No clue. And I would have been holding a sign that said, welcome home for jail. Thanks for keeping the family tradition alive.
Yes.
No clue who was coming off the plane.
Who's that guy?
Just hanging out with the other dinosaurs, a herd of dinosaurs at the airport. Oh, I'm going to have to just, next time I go to the airport, keep that in the truck just in case. Run back out, grab it, come back in.
You got to be prepared.
Got to be prepared. The one time I wasn't, shame on me. Well, hope everybody had a great Christmas. Wishing you all the best in 2026. And hopefully there's lots of paddling involved in the coming year. We're in right now, even. Because, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, it's not winter.
This is true.
This is true.
And if you have, like, if you enjoy wave riding and stuff, like, I saw people surfing, pictures online on social media of people surfing on some of the Great Lakes because of the heavy winds. And people do that with kayaks as well.
Yep.
I don't think I'd do it with a canoe, though. But kayaks, you see people do it with kayaks a lot.
You're sounding pretty wussy. Let's go get that canoe right now.
Let's do it.
Yeah, those waves. And well, I somebody posted a bunch of pictures of Lake Superior, and I'm thinking, you would almost think I was up there.
I know, right?
Waves were massive coming off Lake Superior right now.
Yesterday Lake Erie experienced a huge seiche, which is basically wind-driven water.
Mm-hmm.
So on the western end of Lake Erie, it had gone dry. And on the eastern end at Buffalo, it had rose up 13 feet.
Yeah.
And so it's like you got lake bed everywhere. It's like that's wild.
Right?
Hmm.
Yeah. Even here, I wish I was off work yesterday because I would have went down to Oshawa and did some black and white photos
of
the weather, right?
Yeah.
That would have been awesome. But unfortunately, you know, had to work. Got to pay the mortgage. Got to pay the new truck. So, yeah.
I had some trees taken down recently, and I took the opportunity to stack all the logs, and now my back and legs are sore.
We got a notice today saying that the township is going to be coming to prune our tree before March 13th, so we have to move any decorations from the tree.
Is there, you have power lines?
No.
Why are they going to trim it?
I don't know.
On the one on your lawn?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess it's encroaching on the road.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. All I know is I can stand under there on the road and my garbage stays dry. So, and my leaf bags, yeah, when I put them out, stay dry. So usually I guess maybe it's just bother. Too far out.
That's weird, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
Because it's a tree on your lawn.
Yep. But it's city property. The tree gets looked after by the city. Yep.
Really?
Yep. Huh. Yep. So they drive the neighborhoods every couple of years and look for sicker, overgrown trees, and they trim them back. They're not going to like massively trim it back. Usually they just cut a couple branches. It's because it's hanging extra low, or in case there's a fire truck that has to come by or something.
Should ask them to do the backyard stuff too.
Right. Hey, guys, well, while you're here with those chainsaws, why don't you just cut them bad boys down? Thanks, man.
I'll clean things up.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Oh, well. Speaking of nice weather down in the Southern Hemisphere,
yes,
we'll just jump right into this today.
We have a couple Southern Hemisphere stories today.
We do. Let's start with South Africa. Because, you know.
Why not?
Yeah. South African summers beg to be spent on the water. Whether you want a gentle family paddle, a wild multi-day canoe trip through the desert gorges, or a scenic paddle between vineyards, the country's rivers and dams offer something for every paddler. Here are the best spots to drop a kayak or board this summer and how to make the most of them. Like I say, it's summertime down there now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Orange River, a classic multi-day adventure. So get your Google Maps out if you're thinking about going down that way. Or if you are down that way.
Yes.
For paddlers after epic scenery and a true wilderness vibe, the Orange River is tough to beat. Stretching along the border of Namibia, sections of the Orange offer multi-day canoe and rafting trips through the rugged Richtersveld. Expect desert cliffs, starry nights, and a mix of placid pools and playful rapids. Several operators run guided trips that include meals and camping gear, making it ideal for outdoor newcomers and seasoned paddlers alike. Mm-hmm. Breed River, which we've talked about many things on there before. Wine country floats and family fun. Just a couple hours from Cape Town, the Breed River weaves through the vinlands, combining easy paddling and a beautiful riverbank and nearby wine farms. Day trips and guided raft runs are available, and the river's gentle flow make it a great choice for families and mixed ability groups. Many operators pair paddling with picnics or wine tasting stops, so you can turn a morning glide into a full day outing.
I'm looking up these rivers on maps. There, some of them are really huge.
Yeah, yeah. This seems to be. This isn't the first place we found this where they include, like, on a river trip, hitting up different vineyards.
Well, it makes sense, right? Pardon me.
Your wine going down the wrong tube there?
I inhaled too fast.
Wine?
Well, it's like, well, we saw, what is it, Kevin Kellen on the Spey River?
Oh, yeah, he did all the whiskey tours.
He did the whiskey tour.
Yeah.
There's
and then in Portugal, there was all those ones.
And there's, oh, in the U.S., there's the canal where you can do, pub crawl type thing. There's, it makes sense. It's like combined.
As long as you're not getting hammered out on the water, you're
exactly
good.
Exactly.
Garden root rivers, sheltered estuaries, and forested gorges. The Garden Roots waterways from Cayamans to Toe, the wilderness estuaries, are perfect for paddlers who want scenic, sheltered conditions and easy access to coastal towns. Paddle to waterfalls, explore mangrove-lined estuaries, or launch from a lagoon and head toward a coastal mouth. Many local outfitters offer rentals and guided tours, making these rivers ideal for visitors staying in Nisna, Wilderness or Mossel Bay. The Vaal Dam and Vaal River, weekend escapes and water sports hubs. These are cool because if you're going on a trip and you don't have a lot of time, you can do day trip stuff, right?
Exactly.
Well, get out on a day for a day trip or something. close to Haoteng, the Vol Dam and Vol River are the classic weekend paddling playgrounds for Johannesburg and Pretoria residents. The broad waters are suitable for kayaking, stand-up paddleboarding, and gentle motorboat traffic. Gentle motorboat traffic?
What do they mean by that?
I guess slow-moving motorboats.
There's a speed limit.
There'd have to be. Shore facilities, restaurants, and accommodations make an easy social getaway. Pick quieter weekdays or early mornings in summer to avoid the busiest weekend crowds.
That sounds very appealing.
Doesn't it? Hartbeespoort Dam. Scenic paddles with mountain views. This sounds good. Set beneath the Mahaliesburg, Hardy's Hartbeespoort is a scenic dam with plenty of leisure paddling on offer. It's accessible for day trips from Pretoria and Johannesburg, and the surrounding attractions, cableways, and markets make it a good base for a relaxed summer outing. As with any popular spot, launch early in the day for calmer water and fewer boats. You know, we always complain about, oh yeah, afternoon winds. It seems to be a worldwide phenomenon.
I think it's just a natural thing. The sun comes up, it changes temperatures, it get more lift and so on, and so it causes wind to move around.
Yeah, yeah. It's worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the sun should just like only come up so far and then go back down.
Yeah.
Right? And we don't have to worry about it. quick safety and planning tips if you're going to head to South Africa and any of these sort of things. Check conditions. River flows, dam surface winds, and seasonal rains can change paddling conditions quickly. Local outfitters provide the best up-to-date advice. And if you're going with a outfitter, hire reputable operators.
I didn't know which ones are reputable.
Well, you have to do some research. Especially for rapids or multi-day trips, experienced guides, proper gear, and safety briefings matter. And that's with anywhere you go.
Oh, yeah.
You got to be Googling the different ones and get the reviews and stuff like that. Sun, hydration, and kit. Always carry sun protection, plenty of water, a whistle, and a leash for stand-up paddle boards or kayaks. There's not enough sun protection for me. I look at the news and it says it's going to be sunny and boom, I've got a sunburn. Like I burn that fast. What's that? Oh, SPF 600? Yeah, that'll work. Leave no trace. Pack out rubbish, respect wildlife, and avoid trampling riverine vegetation.
Oh, I've never seen that word before.
Mm-hmm. Permits and private land. Some dams or river put-ins are on private property. Check access rules and park fees in advance. Some of the waterways best for beginners and families: the Breed River, the Garden Route estuaries, and the Vol Dams. Best for day trips: Vol Dam, Hartbeespoort, and Kayamans on the Garden Route. Best for multi-day trips: the Orange River guided canoe expeditions through the Richterveld. That'd be something to do for, mm-hmm. like, multiple days.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to be researching what kind of wildlife would be down there. So I don't think they have the hippos and...
Well, yeah, I don't know. But that's south, definitely right? You don't often think to research wildlife where you're going to be... Like, I guess for here, you're used to, well, it's going to be bears, moose. Okay.
If you go north...
Research
here,
done.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, well, you really have to look into things if it's going to be like, you know, anywhere else. Like, you know, you could have scorpions, you could have alligators,
snakes.
Hippos, right?
Yeah. Giant spiders.
Yes. Right? Yes. So.
But, I mean, you want to see if you're a birder and you're going to go on a multi-day trip, find out what kind of birds are going to be down there, right? Don't leave it to the last second because you'll.
Set up your checklist and get your camera ready.
Right. Yeah, because I got to think, yeah, you're not going down there and seeing giraffes and cheetahs and elephants.
Who knows?
In South Africa?
Mm-hmm.
Way down there?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know. Maybe a penguin or two.
Okay, I'll have to Google it.
Oh, you're going
to
Google it. Summer paddling in South Africa offers an unbeatable mix of landscapes, desert gorges, lush winelands, coastal estuaries, and highland dams. Pick the water that matches your skill and vibe. Book with a trusted operator when in doubt, and you'll have long days on the water to remember. There is a play, an online magazine called Getaway Magazine that talks a lot about this. You can go to their website and find getaway.co.za. So did you find it?
Yeah.
And what's down in South Africa animal-wise?
South Africa's most dangerous wildlife includes the classic Big Five. Lions, leopards, elephant, rhino, and buffalo. Plus
really?
There are hippos and crocodiles.
In South Africa?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yep.
I didn't think they'd venture that far south.
For aggressive power, highly venomous snakes like the black mamba and the puff adder. While the mosquito is a significant threat to disease transmission, making hippos, crocs, buffalo, and dangerous reptiles top concerns for human safety.
So you won't go because of the mosquitoes. Come for the hippos, stay for the mosquitoes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That'd be cool, though, to see that. On a canoe trip?
Everything I've seen about hippos is they're just super dangerous.
And fast in the water.
Very fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, baboons.
I'm sure you could take one.
I don't even think I could run faster than one.
I don't think anybody can run faster than one. I bet you could outrun a cheetah.
What?
Sure you could. Come on, Derek, give it a whirl, buddy.
If I was running with you.
Give it a whirl. All you got to do is trip your buddy. Same rules as the bears. That'd be cool, though, to check out some of the scenery down there.
It would be, yes.
And like you say, paddling along. I honestly didn't think they were, I mean, it's not top of my list of animals where they roam.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really think they were, I thought they were like farther north towards the top two thirds of Africa,
yeah,
I guess I would say.
I don't see a map, a locational map.
Yeah. Great. Now I'm going to have to learn more. But even still, if you were on a canoe trip, a multi-day canoe trip,
yeah,
and you have me paddling by and see elephants down beside the river or giraffes or something.
Amazing.
That'd be like, you could just turn around then and call it the end of the trip and say it was the best trip ever.
Let me try something else.
And as long as they were on the other shore, not like, you know, charging you.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway.
So, yeah. It's all down South Africa. It's like the Big Five. And it shows a map by color for zones that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's a lot of them just down by Cape Town and so on.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh. I figure being more populated, they wouldn't be.
Well,
more populous areas.
There's populous areas, but there's also a lot of space, mm-hmm. open area.
Hmm. Yeah, it's just never somewhere I've ever really checked into, right?
Yeah.
On how they're, like I say, I'm figuring top two thirds of the country is where they all are sort of hanging out.
Yeah. It's so here's this map. It's by color. So the darkest, how many Big Five can be found in these areas? So in the darker areas, all five.
Okay.
So here's Cape Town down here. So there's a lot of, there's a lot in Central Africa, Central yeah. South Africa. But there's down towards the tip, it's there. It's just these.
Everywhere.
These Big Five animals are everywhere.
Wow. So I guess we know where we're going now.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. Wow. Wow. Wow.
Owen.
Owen Wilson, baby. Wow. Again, getaway.co.za if you want to find out more information and find out what you can do down in South Africa if you're looking to do some paddling. We've been talking over the last couple of years about dams and the removal of dams. But now we come across an article. The Yusufel Dam in the Black Sea city of Artvin has evolved from a feat of engineering into an elite aquatic arena. It's an expansive reservoir now serving as a consistent year-round facility for Turkey's national canoe and rafting athletes. So they've taken this massive dam, and there's a video. I sent you the video. Like, the engineering that went into this thing
is incredible. So much concrete.
And the amount of valley that it filled With what?
Exactly.
How many towns were buried by this water?
Seven villages.
Seven villages are now underwater. Mm-hmm. Built across the wild currents of the Sora River, the Yusufeli Dam reaches a height of 275 meters, securing its place as the tallest dam in Turkey, with the fifth highest in the world. Primarily designed for hydroelectric power generation, the massive structure is now also playing a role in sports development. Rising above the submerged ruins of seven villages in the former district, the Yusufeli Reservoir now hosts a new generation of water sports athletes from the Olympic Preparation Center, the TOHM. This vast expanse provides athletes with a strategic advantage: serene, calm waters that offer a flawless training environment throughout the winter season. Canoe and rafting athletes train on the reservoir to prepare for national team camps, using the still water to focus on endurance, strength, balance, and technique, while continuing whitewater training in other regions when conditions allow. Now, their canoes are actually kayaks.
Yes.
As we know, they sometimes call kayaks canoes. Yusufeli canoe team coach Emre Ertek said, "Calm water training has become especially important since the relocation of the district following the dam's completion. Canoeing has been practiced in Yusufeli for many years, and our athletes are very successful. After the old settlement was flooded at the end of 2022, we moved to the new district. In the past, we trained mainly on white water. Now, especially in winter, we rely more on calm water, which is ideal for conditioning and strength training. Athletes say the reservoir has allowed them to continue training consistently despite the ongoing construction of the new whitewater courses." So that's pretty cool that it keeps them going, right? You're not having to take that break. Canoe athlete Yagmur Arslan, who has been practicing the sport for 5 years, encouraged newcomers to try it. "I truly love canoeing and highly recommend it to anyone curious about the sport," she says. "If you believe in yourself, come join us. There's absolutely nothing to be afraid of." Another athlete described canoeing as both challenging and enjoyable. "We train on the reservoir while our course is still under construction. It's a sport worth trying. To see the limits of what's possible, you have to try the impossible." Athlete Bazik Kurt also highlighted the appeal of the sport, saying canoeing is enjoyable, safe, and something everyone should experience.
So if it's a practice area for Olympians, then this must be sprint training and so on, right?
Yeah. Well, it's nice. I saw a couple of pictures there. You know, they got all the athletes out in their boats, and the coach is sitting there explaining on how to do different things, and then they book in. But it's like it's so calm there.
Yes.
Right? That you can go and try, not have to worry about doing it in waves.
Yes. And it's a really deep gorge, so it's relatively protected from winds and so on.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool that, you know, I mean, everybody uses it only for one thing. Hydroelectricity.
Yeah.
But now they've actually been able to say, hey, you know what? We got this area. Let's do some training there. And it's becoming a training center now, which is pretty cool. Staying on that side of the world still, India's rafting industry. A lot of issues over the last few years.
Yeah, we reported on a few of them. There's been various
fights
incidents.
Fights.
Oh,
people
yes.
falling over and drowning. Yeah, there's been a lot of incidents. Safety and training has been a big part of those issues.
That's what's been identified, yes. They're saying it, the people just aren't trained up to the level to be protective. But to say, you know, you can't be losing. You can only lose so many tourists before things start to go downhill, right?
Well, you know. It's not like you can put, well, we're under 10 this year. I don't know. You're getting the closest.
We're still under the acceptable limit.
Yeah, we're still under the acceptable number. Zero would be better. So we've been talking about that last few years about the issues that are going on over there and whatnot. And they put a halt to rafting in a few spots because of safety and whatnot. And the Uttarakhand government will now allow only technically skilled and certified guides for rafting in the state's rivers. which you would think
it should already be that.
Had already been there.
Yes. But I guess if you, it's private industry, so I guess it, really governments tend to stay arm's length until you start killing people.
Well, until you start looking at the numbers.
Hmm.
The government has decided that 900 rafting guides across the state would be provided training to enhance their technical proficiency in first aid and CPR, as a plan is afoot to raise their working age from the present 50 to 60 years. So there's 900 rafting guides. They're now going to train.
That's crazy. Right? That's a lot of guides.
And now you don't have to retire at 50. You can stay on until 60.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we're going to let them stay that extra 10 years, we might as well give them some first aid and CPR training and stuff like that. Rafting guides operating in Ganga and other rivers in Uttarakhand will now be mandatorily required to undergo skill development training and 3-day first aid training program to be able to take up the work in the future.
Very cool.
Training will cover first aid and CPR to ensure that guides can provide immediate medical assistance to rafters in the event of accidents and other hours of needs. They will also have to equip themselves with technically qualified certificates from competent agencies before formally taking up the job of rafting guides. So basically, you got to be trained to be a rafting guide. You can't just go out on Saturday and go, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to take people out on a raft.
I'm going to wing it.
Yeah, we're going to wing it.
I've been a tourist a few times. I can handle this.
I went down the river once. I could do that with a boatload of people. The decision was taken by the State Tourism Department following a demand raised by Rafters Association in the state. The State Tourism Secretary, Dhiraj Garbal, said, has confirmed the decision on the mandatory first aid training and imparting skilled proficiency for the rafting guides in the states. However, according to the secretary, no final decision was taken on the age limit, but a consensus was reached to increase the maximum age limit for rafting guides from 50 to 60 years.
So
I think it would depend on the 60-year-old.
It would depend on the individual, but what they're saying is that instead of getting booted out of the job at 50, if you're healthy enough, you can keep going until you're 60.
Mid-50s.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I make it, yeah. No.
Wait a sec.
Wait a minute.
I'm still healthy enough.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Give them that extra 10 years of work, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, if they're able to do the job, then go for it, but that's up to them. According to Garbial, a consensus was arrived at following a meeting with Rafters Association. It was decided in the meeting with the association that 900 rafting guides across the state will be provided training to enhance their technical proficiency in first aid and CPR. Training will be conducted by Hannafal Center USA. A senior tourism official said a training program for rafting guides will be in the first week of January 2026. It's notable that the Rafting Association also raised other important issues in the meeting with the department. They included setting up rafting camps on riverbanks, reassessment of carrying capacity of River Ganga, infrastructural improvements on rafting pickup points from the main roads, and the provision for ambulances for the safety of tourists. So it seems like they're looking to better the whole industry, not just... Okay, not only are we going to train these guys, but the pickup points, how many people we can send out on the river at any given time and all that stuff. And if something happens, can the ambulances get them picked up on and get them to the hospital and stuff like that? So hopefully they're going to do this and go with it.
Hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, so I just think like, wait a minute, you got 900 guides that aren't fully trained?
I'm just amazed that they have 900 guides. That's a big number.
Right? How many boats?
Hmm.
One or two guides per boat?
Probably. They're rafting, right?
Yeah. So that's an awful lot of rafts.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's all throughout the, not just one river either.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's spread out.
Yeah. So
pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? And you gotta make it safe. If you're getting the tourists in there from around the world.
And yeah, from around the world.
And that's like, a big draw too, right?
From what we've seen, a lot of their business is people from India. And so it's a lot of locals doing these things on weekends and whatnot, just like we would do going out of river and so on. But there's also a very large number of people from around the world that are showing up to run these rivers.
Well, yeah. And when we look, like you say, the last couple of years, all we're seeing is, oh yeah, these people died and these people are lost and there was this big accident and there was fights where rafts are coming so close to each other and getting ticked off and
people whacking each other with paddles
and stuff. And it's like, yeah, I don't want to go there. You know, and that's when you're going to start looking into everything and find out nobody's trained.
Yes.
Where's your training information? Nothing. What's on your safety protocols?
They're trained to operate the raft. They're probably all very qualified rafting guides, but they need some first aid CPR qualifications too.
Because things do happen.
Exactly. And right? And you can't always, if you're on the side of a river, you can't always wait for somebody to be flown in or whatever, right?
No.
You need to be able to respond immediately to an incident, an event where somebody becomes hurt or whatever.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. It does make sense that the state is taking these actions.
20 rafts leaving at the same time. Right? So they got to be able to figure, okay, we can only have this many.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of.
Yeah. So they're going to set some rules and carrying capacity, yada, yada, yada.
Awesome.
Yeah, that last paragraph really kind of sums it up about all the stuff they're going to do about carrying capacity of the river and the rafting camps and pickup points and et cetera. So on.
All the infrastructure.
It needs to be, bumped up a bit.
Yeah. And then maybe we'll go.
Mm-hmm.
But until then.
Mm-hmm.
Explorer's Web. I was on Explorer's Web talking about they're been posting their top 10 expeditions of 2025. Number 3, an inland Australian paddle. So it's not one of these big paddles that are going across the ocean, which seem to be
there's been a lot of
last year into this year was big. Everybody's paddling across from continent to continent.
Yeah.
But this was Australia, inland paddle on rivers. And I mean, when you stop to think about it, like again, sunburns. Heat when you're going in there and stuff like that. That's all you're thinking. And everything wants to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So let's just hop in a boat and paddle our little hearts out. Each year it seems a little harder to find original expeditions, but Alan Davison's 6,800-kilometer kayak journey certainly qualifies. He called his solo kayak journey Australia's longest inland paddle. Though we can't confirm it's the longest, it's certainly one of them. A mammoth 136-day undertaking took him through the Southern Hemisphere's autumn and winter, stitching together a route that began in Condamine, Queensland, near Brisbane, and finished in Coorong, South Australia, traced the Condamine, Ballon, Bokara, Darling, and Murrumbidgee, and Coorong River Systems, Murrumbidgee. That's a hard one.
It's quite the word, yeah.
This was an all-new territory for Davison, an accomplished kayaker who had previously completed source-to-sea descents of the Murray, 2,500 kilometers, Darling, 1,600 kilometers, and Murrumbidgee, 1,200 kilometers. However, stitching them together with a lengthy detour to fit in the Murrumbidgee represented a significant expanded challenge.
These are a lot of kilometers he's traveled.
These are huge. In April, Davison set out from Warwick in southern Queensland on the Condamine River in a 17-foot Prion Kodiak kayak. He couldn't ease into the paddle. The Beardmore Dam closes its gates in winter, causing water levels on the Condamine River to drop precipitously. First leg was a sprint, with my fingers crossed that the trip wasn't going to end prematurely. He said, low water levels, weirs, and road crossings made this opening section tricky, but he still knocked over roughly 1,000 kilometers in 16 days. Wow. I have no problems doing log jams, rock gardens, all that sort of stuff in a canoe when you're in, out.
Mm-hmm.
I would, like, within the day, I would call it quits if I had to do that from a kayak.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, like, yeah, no, I'll wait till spring.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
the waters come back. Could you imagine getting in and out of a kayak all day long for 16 days?
What's the meanest link is 400 and some odd kilometers, which includes 100 and some odd kilometers of, 80 some kilometers
portaging.
Of portages. And most people are doing that in 7 to 10 days. If you're taking it easy, it's probably about 12 to 15 days. And so, but that's only like 400 and some odd kilometers.
That's in a canoe.
Yeah. And yeah. so this guy did 1,000 kilometers in 16 days.
He was booking it.
Oh, yeah.
Continuing on the Balon River into the Kolgowa floodplains, Davison was now fairly remote with no cell coverage. On the Bokhara River, paper bark trees made it an obstacle course. On the worst day, I had to do around 50 portages and likely around 150 difficult traverses through the canopies. Three or five point turns, pulling myself over logs, breaking off branches to open a path through, scraping on mud around the edge. Despite all the scrambling, he notched another 500 kilometers in 10 days.
Incredible.
By May 6th, Davison had completed the Bokhara, and continued east on the Barwon and Darling rivers, which flow for 1,700 kilometers through outback country before joining the Murray. This area swings between bone-dry stretches and areas of flooding, and Davison was lucky to arrive behind a moderate flood that he could ride downstream. Talk about timing.
Mm-hmm.
Floodwaters meant he could leave the narrow river channel and paddle across the flooded plains when convenient. While paddling the lower Darling, Davison stopped twice to rescue trapped animals stuck in the muddy banks. Cool.
There you go.
At the end of the Lower Darling River, with another 1,700 kilometers down and over 50 days to his expedition, Davison would now head upstream on the massive 2,500-kilometer detour up the Murrumbidgee River.
He's going upriver.
Mm-hmm. Curiosity if this was possible was the main driving factor for this rather long detour, he says.
I wonder if I can do this.
Yeah. The Murrumbidgee delivers irrigation water across New South Wales. In summer, flows can surge above 10,000 megaliters per day, but in winter they drop significantly. Yet Davison was determined and lucky with a good low flow for much of the next 52 days. The flip side of a consistent flow was that the detour became monotonous. Despite this, Davison described it as a physically challenging and rewarding tour. I mean, if he were to do this exact same thing next year,
it could be
completely
exactly
crapola, right? Some days are just luck of the draw. Davison took a week off before beginning the final stretch of his long inland paddle. July 24th, he pushed back out on the Murray, which is Australia's longest river, paddling through past multicolored cliffs, red gum forests, and towering sandstone cliffs below the town of Renmark. He finally emerged into a lagoon system at the Murray mouth. Davison had cruised through another 1,032 kilometers, his total distance to 6,800 kilometers by the time he exited his kayak at Coorong near Adelaide on August 23rd. Over 119 paddling days, he suffered two capsizes, both after getting caught on snags, and averaged nearly 57 kilometers per day with the longest push of 120 in 15 hours on the Darling. Technically, his expedition ended here, but in a surprise twist. he wasn't done. He headed home, not by plane, but rather paddling back upstream. First up the Murray, bringing in the combined total distance for the trip to 10,575 kilometers over 215 days with at least 22 rest days and into the Darling River Basin. Needless to say, this takes an already enormous trip and supersizes it. Though ocean kayak journeys sometimes top this sort of distance, inland paddles are generally far shorter, and Davison's claim of Australia's longest inland paddle strengthens by the day as he worked his way back upstream. Looking outside of Australia, his distance now easily eclipses source-to-sea trips on the Amazon. Exactly how far he goes is out of his control as water levels drop ahead of him. Whatever the final distance, Davison's Herculean effort and wonderfully original idea make it one of the top expeditions of 2025.
Wow. I can't imagine the level of
Let's
work.
Let's go 6,800 kilometers with a big detour in the middle of that. And we get there. Let's turn around and go back. Let's not. See, we did. I mean, if you got the time.
Yeah, if you got the time.
Right? It didn't say what kind of animals he rescued.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about the logistics because obviously he's getting food drops and so on.
They didn't get into any of that. They were just talking about the distances and trips and directions and rivers and stuff like that. But yeah, the logistics, if it was whether he's mailing stuff or somebody was, I mean, that's a long way to go for somebody to be following him.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, no, you probably have the drop points, right? It's if, you know, I'm crossing this road, I'm crossing under this bridge or whatever. It's so make sure you have a food drop for me there, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. But it's not like he's got a buddy following him in a car.
Probably not.
Yeah.
No, these things go way out in the middle of the outback and so on.
What's one of my most favorite things?
Well, I'm cheating because I already read. But I'll blow the surprise. It's Dunkin' Donuts.
Donuts, actually, baby.
Donuts. Not
donuts. I am not specific as to particular companies. If it starts with a D and ends in O-Nut, I will probably eat it. There can sometimes be too much of a good thing. Some residents of Haverhill, Massachusetts, say the smell from the new Dunkin' factory is just too much, and they want something to be done about it. My house smells like donuts all the time for the last 2 months. It's distracting, and it's heavy, Haverhill resident Sean Wilson says, and I must be embarrassing because he spells his name the same way as me. I'm ashamed. I don't know what that's going to smell like during the summer.
I know. Can you imagine?
The factory is owned by Kafua Management Company at nearly 100,000 square feet.
Huge.
It's the largest bakery for Dunkin' in the U.S. Somewhere along the way, I think they dropped donuts. It's not Dunkin' Donuts. It's Dunkin'.
Yeah.
Well, I think they dropped the donut somewhere along the way.
Mm-hmm.
It was built early this year and is serving more than 200 Dunkin' shops that are run by Kafua. Representative appeared before city council, and the rep said the factory makes around 1 million donuts a day.
That's so much.
Your Honor, I did not break into that facility. I don't care what you say. I don't know how those donuts appeared in my truck. The facility has brand new equipment, is regularly cleaned, and meets all regulatory standards. City council members said some residents are concerned about air quality near the plant. Council is having health inspectors check out the plant, and they will revisit the issue at their January meeting. Could you imagine waking up in the morning to the smell of fresh baked donuts?
But see,
and dozing off at night. Good night, honey.
Donuts.
Donuts. I'm dreaming of donuts all
I think
night
even
long.
You would get tired of that if it was
Hush
every
your
day.
Mouth.
Every day.
Every day. So my work in the summer where I work, there's the dad's cookies.
Okay.
in Scarborough, and you can smell them. When I get out of my truck in the morning, yeah, in the parking lot at work, oh, cookies. So you mix that with donuts.
A million a day.
Now, what they need to do is next door to this, build a coffee plant. And all you're going to smell is coffee and donuts 365 days a year. Like, there's got to be some sort of tourist trap there. I got to admit, yes, I you got to think at some point you're going to be, yeah, okay, you know what? Mm-hmm. Enough with the donuts. But looking from the outside, looking in,
yeah,
I don't know what you people are complaining about. And now if anybody lives down there, yeah, let me come and visit for a while.
Incredible.
That's something, though. A million donuts a day.
It's a lot.
What's a whole a million lot divided by 200? If there's a million donuts for 200 stores.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think smelling the donuts is their biggest problem.
That's a lot of donuts.
That's a lot of donuts for a store. Wow. Anyway, amazing. Hang on a second here. Massachusetts, Haverhill.
You're going to Google it?
I could get there in a day and a half. Sorry. Was that my outside voice? all right, let's head across the country here to Oregon. Oregon lawmakers pushing to narrow a new statewide boat permit requirement that has drawn criticism from paddlers and other recreational water users. Dun, 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 dun. Rep. Dwayne Yunker has drafted a bill that would exempt more small, non-motorized watercraft from needing a waterway access permit by changing the state's definition of a boat. The proposal would exclude non-motorized vessels shorter than 11 feet, including stand-up paddleboards. Less than 11 feet. So when we're driving or paddling our 16-foot canoes and kayaks, and that's not going to include us. After a law passed earlier this year, most boats used on Oregon waterways will be required to have a waterway access permit starting in 2026. Requirement would apply to kayaks, paddleboards, and other small craft. This expands a prior exemption that covered watercraft under 10 feet.
Hmm.
State officials say the permit program is intended to raise money to prevent invasive mussels from spreading in Oregon's lakes and rivers. Permit costs vary by type and size, with prices set at $6 for 1 week permit, $20 for a 1 year permit, and $35 for a 2 year permit. Permits will be available through Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Oregon State Marine Board. Now,
it's not a lot of money, but I think it's just the principle of it. It's like, I'm going to take my self-powered watercraft out on this river and I have to buy a permit to access it.
If you want to go cruising through locks, you got to buy a permit.
Sure.
Right?
You're using facilities.
Yeah. My thing would be, I want proof they're using it for what they say they're using it for.
Yes.
If I have no problems paying, and I'd probably do the $35 to save myself $5 in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problems paying it if it's going to help keep the waterways clean from invasive species.
If they're responsible with it.
Yeah. If they can prove that's indeed what you're using that money for, I would personally have no problems doing that. But if they're not going to prove, oh, we're taking your money, what's being used for?
Yeah.
Invasive species cleaning. Yeah, that's the ticket. I would have an issue with that.
And with a lot of these things, the money goes into general revenue.
Yeah.
And then it's doled out to here, there, and everywhere. And if they do have a plan that will work on invasive species, then fine. They're doing something. But if they're bringing in, let's say, $20 million a year and they're spending $200,000 on invasive species, it's like, whoa, wait a sec.
Yeah.
This is now a money grab. So, I don't know. I'd want to see where the money's going.
Yep. Juncker's proposal follows public pushback over the expanded permit requirements, though the bill would still need approval from the legislature to take effect. Now, I thought I had read somewhere that it was in the work. It was would have been another article about this whole permit thing when it was passed back in the spring of 2025. That I believe the permit is transferable.
What do you mean?
If you got four boats.
Oh, I can only use one boat at a time, so I can. It's whatever boat I happen to be using.
Right.
But then what if and you go with family and you got two
then
boats,
you'd then you'd need, you'd need at least two.
And what's the fine if you don't, if you get caught without a pass?
Probably more than $35. So, yeah, so that'll be something to, I guess I know there's a lot of places, a lot of states that have the fees to use.
Yep.
I wouldn't, I'm glad I don't have to pay a fee.
Yep.
But if all of a sudden Ontario said, we got to start paying a fee because we're going to use it for this, I would feel comfortable paying that fee if they're going to prove mm-hmm. they're using it for what they say they're using
exactly.
it for.
Exactly.
Right?
Not just general revenue and another money grab. But it's
Yeah, we're updating the bathrooms. No. Like, forget it. If you're going to make sure the waterways stay clear and update the, you know, it's do it for, you're saying it's for invasive species. Prove you're using that money for invasive species,
mm-hmm.
not, you know, making sure that people aren't destroying the bathrooms. So,
yeah.
Hmm. When you're on paddling trips, how often do you chew gum?
I tend not to chew gum on paddling trips.
Really?
I don't get too close to people, so I'm not worried about my breath. And
that's why people don't get close to you.
Maybe.
Not that people are saying anything, dude.
Yeah. But yeah, I do bring gum with me on trips.
I've always seems to have gum somewhere on a trip mm-hmm. in a pack or something or in the food barrel. Or it's one of those things, I'll just throw that in there.
Mm-hmm.
Got some in the truck, sort of the I'll just throw it in there. Or some in my life jacket or something like that. There was a thing on Gear Junkie by Stephen Reginold. Trailhead Nate Mal is chewing gum. He mashes a slow rhythm, his jawline bouncing, boots shifting on mud below. It's noon in Alaska, a drizzly November day. Mal has set aside a few hours for hiking and foraging in the trees. His mission is spruce resin, a tacky trickle on bark, chipped by hand and commanding up to $250 a pound.
Hmm. That's a lot.
For spruce resin.
Yeah. I remember as a kid, we'd pop off dried spruce resin from trees and chew it.
Mm-hmm.
We used to chew this as a kid all the time.
Yeah, not me. Mal takes sap and melts it down, adds chicle, sap, and powdered clay. In a warehouse 3 years ago, Mal mixed and boiled, experimented, sifted, and strained. A chef by training, he had somehow become obsessed with creating the world's perfect gum. Historianist quest to reinvent chewing gum based on natural ingredients and old world oral health has attracted legions to purchase his products online. With viral videos and unexpected TikTok fame, Mal's startup brand, Underbrush, rocketed this year to $30 million in sales.
That's amazing.
I'm tempted to buy a package of
this. I've seen the ads online. And
have you?
And
now that we're talking about it and our laptops
our phones are listening to us here,
I'm going to be getting, so I'll be able to order some.
It is very expensive, and I have looked at it. It's like, oh, I'm curious. But I'm not willing to spend the kind of money. But now that we're reading the story, maybe I'll buy a pack.
It's a story too strange to pass by. So as the November days grew short, Stephen Reginald got on a plane to Juneau to join Mal and his crew for their final forage of the year. Take this chisel, he says, offering a stout tool and metal pail. The trees are down this trail. Mal and his team have been here before, the forests on Douglas Island, just west of Juneau's city grid, offer the right conditions and the right kind of trees for foraging one of the main ingredients in his gum. Underbrush, which is the product brand under Mel's namesake company, Nathan & Sons, is hardly the first chewable made with resin and sap. Indigenous people pick gooey hunks off tree bark to keep their mouths fresh and teeth clean. Sap's antiseptic qualities were a long-known hack for oral health.
Uh-huh.
Later sold commercially in 1848, inventor John Bacon Curtis, what a great name, produced what was called the State of Maine Pure Spruce Gum. He cooked a spruce-based brew on a stove to make it a sticky substrate that was marketed as a curiosity and a treat. In the dripping Alaska woods, Reginald popped a piece of underbrush in his mouth. Its waxy texture comes from resin and a list of ingredients Mal forages or finds from suppliers around the world. Tart taste has a nostalgic effect and a childhood association with hiking with his dad. As a Minnesota kid, the crust off any pine tree was spruce gum that his dad would offer. The kids chewed it and winced, a tacky grit between our teeth, plodding down the trail. Well, that's exactly it. You just pick it off and you get the little wood bits and bugs and whatever else, right? Underbrush gum is sold in a slide-open box and is cut into cubes. It comes in cinnamon, honey, berry, and mint. I think I'd go with the honey version.
I'll go with the mint.
Each piece has a strong initial hint of flavor that fades into a mild sap taste as you chew. Like a modern-day John Bacon Curtis, Mal found the market intrigued by his spruce-inspired product. The gum is pricey, about $12 a pack. That's not two shabs.
There's if you want to try pieces, it, 12 pieces of gum in it.
Yeah, you're only going to probably buy one just to give it a whirl. But people are buying it so fast that Mal now leases two warehouses in his hometown.
That's crazy.
Underbrush is sugar-free, and the company touts a natural composition that promotes good teeth. Company has built a following being adversarial to Big Gum, which has dropped natural ingredients to adopt synthetic bases, and food-grade plastics common in Bubblicious to Big League Chew. Bubblicious and Hubba Bubba used to be my brand.
Mm. Yep.
When Double Bubble went the way of the dodo in my neighborhoods. Last spring, the New York Times published, "Is Chewing Gum Bad for Your Health?" The article describes how polyethylene and other petro-derived constituents can stand for the chicle and spruce. In the UK, the Ban Plastic Chewing Gum campaign petition has garnered nearly 30,000 signatures. It cites billions of pieces chewed each year in the country and a litany of purported health and environmental consequences as a result. John Bacon Curtis might be rolling in his grave, but for Underbrush, a movement away from Big Gum and towards natural options was ushering in an unexpected trajectory of success. Quest for better chewing gum was never in Mal's life plan. He explored and immersed himself in the outdoors from an early age. Jungle on Guam, where he was born, was Mal's playground, and with his dog as his lone partner, he bushwhacked and got lost in the tropical brush. He collected bugs and caught snakes, foraging in nature from the start. Family moved to California, seeking opportunity and a better life. Job at a restaurant steered him into a career based around food. In Alaska, Mal leaned into his chef skills, made crew dinner one night, a forest-to-table theme, meant local ingredients, and found items from the woods. There was a bowl of spruce resin to try raw. As a chef and later the owner of his own place, he worked long hours and was stressed out. He chewed gum like anyone for flavor, fresh breath, and to fight fidgeting. And that's it. I chew gum, well, besides for fresh breath, but stop chewing my nails.
Yeah.
Right? If I find I'm chewing my nails, I throw gum in my mouth.
Yeah.
At an airport one day, bored, he randomly flipped over a pack of Juicy Fruit, scanned the ingredient list. It read sugar, corn syrup, dextrose, phenylalanine, glycerol, and aspartame. Although not a vegan, Mal was at the time head chef at a high-end vegan restaurant focused on natural food. At the airport, he thought, why am I chewing on this artificial crap? Another moment of destiny would arrive soon after. In 2022, Mal fell victim to a toothache so excruciating that he could barely think. It took a week to see his dentist, and during the day's waiting, he started to research natural cures to relieve the pain. He discovered the tales of resin and indigenous tribes and spruce harvests in Alaska. He read about natural minerals that could help fortify the surface of the tooth. Mal and the chef started messing around. Resin, mastic, chicle, and mint. He added candelilla wax, myrrh, and eggshell dust. Like, only a chef would know that.
Yeah.
Hang on. I got some eggshell dust over here. It took hundreds of experiments to get the taste and texture right. Early versions disintegrated or stuck between his teeth, and there's nothing worse than that. Some were so bitter he spit them out. Eventually, a smooth chewing formula came to life, and Mal had a product ready to present to the world. The Gastineau Channel is an icy waterway between Juneau and the archipelago, stretching hundreds of miles to the north. It's a region of fjords and glaciers, cliffs, waterfalls, and forests. This hike led north from the trailhead toward the water. It was an hour into the adventure, and the underbrush group was near a known foraging point. As it seems, sounds like as well that they are sticking to certain areas and not just going all willy-nilly, right? Which is pretty cool. Soon the scent of salt water hit the air. Near the shoreline are the Sitka trees, and Mal was demonstrating the removal of resin from the trunk. Be careful not to damage the bark, he says. Mal's pail filled with dust and sticky chunks. The goal is a pound of foraging bounty, enough to make 1,000 pieces of gum.
Oof.
1 pound for 1,000 pieces.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad.
And he buys the stuff, or the value of the pure gum itself.
$250.
$250 a pound.
Yeah. Just a couple of years ago, Mal would have been out here alone. Now he runs the Alaska trips to scout for sources. He employs foragers from around the continent to find seeps on trees. The demand is so high that underbrush has looked at buying acreage and pine lines in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. For now, the tracks on Douglas Island will need to do. Mal has returned here 5 times in recent months to oversee a stable of freelance foragers and fulfill supply. 2 days, Mal and crew will head home. Shipments of mastic are arriving from Greece. Case of chicle is waiting in a crate. And the spruce is coming from Juneau, and the underbrush factory is ready to go.
That's amazing.
Isn't that something, though? Like,
yeah.
It's old, old indigenous,
yep.
You know, that, ways they would do it.
Made
they would chew
again.
It.
Yeah.
And then you get, you know, based on, well, this guy back in, Mr. Bacon there, back in the 1850s was doing this. And they said, yeah, I got to get something new here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get away from all the garbage.
It's pretty
and
cool.
Try something natural.
Mm-hmm.
I want to try a pack. I might buy a pack or two.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you know if I'm going to. Well, give it a whirl. Chew it. Question is, if it sticks, will it pull your fillings out?
Oh, yeah.
Right? But it says it's good, like, they got the fresh breath part.
Well, he said he's...
And it's good for putting that, strengthening the outside of your teeth.
Yep.
But it doesn't say it makes them whiter.
No, it doesn't.
You still need to brush and floss.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, of course.
And get that stuff off your teeth that from the gum you've been chewing. Pretty cool, though. That's pretty cool.
It is.
Yeah, like I say, when we're out doing our trips, I've always got gum somewhere.
Yep.
Not always chewing it, but, you know, like I say, my PFD or in the food barrel or my day pack or something, there's always gum somewhere.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll have to start bringing some of this...
try it out, yeah.
Underbrush gum along.
Interesting.
Yeah, you guys want some
it's a natural
pine
product.
Gum? Some... Yeah.
He tries to keep it as natural as possible.
Yep.
And like gum manufacturers, like you buy gum nowadays and like the plasticated gum, like he was talking, it's like, it's,
Well, you get like this Trident or the little cube gum thingy pieces. Yeah. And, I mean, it's got that hard candy shell.
Yeah.
It's almost like biting through a plastic.
Yes. And so, once the sugar's gone, it just grows hard as a rock.
Yeah. Well, I was chewing a piece the other day. We were stopped at one of the en route stations there, the rest stops on the side of the 401 highway going towards Ottawa. My gums lost its purpose. Because I'm just chewing for the sake of chewing now.
Yeah.
There was no flavor. There was no nothing left. Yeah. So that's all I've got.
I've got nothing to add. I'm still looking at maps. Right now I'm on Haverhill looking for this donut factory.
Looking for the donut factory. Yeah. Maps are wonderful, aren't they?
They are.
I think everybody should be into maps. Map hub.
Well, we talked recently about taking map reading skills over the winter.
Yeah.
It's one of those things. I think more people should get into it. You never know when we're going to need those skills.
Learn to use maps and compasses. Because, when the zombies happen, it's not going to be GPSs up there. You're going to need your map skills. Otherwise, doomed. Doomed, I tell you. All righty. That's all I've got. That's all you got. And if you want to find more about us, you can find us on paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And you can download or stream our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. And we're also on Good Pods now, apparently. Or you can go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com and stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.